Hello and welcome to another episode of I Am The Egg Pod, hosted by me, Chris Shaw. You can find me on Twitter as @ChrisShawEditor. The Egg Pods will take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatles albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, I'm joined by dramatist, author and playwright Dan Rebelato. Dan can be found on Twitter as @DanRebelato. In today's episode, we're going to be talking about the Beatles' final album from 1970, Let It Be. The first question I have to ask is, why did you pick this particular album?
I guess I picked this album not because it's my favourite Beatles album, or I think it's the best Beatles album, but because I think it's the most fascinating Beatles album. And the reason I say that is that with this album, unlike any other, you can kind of ask the question, what would the perfect version of Let It Be like? Be, yeah. And whereas, you know, it doesn't make any sense to say, you know, what would the perfect version of Rubber Soul be? Because we've got the perfect version of Rubber Soul, it's Rubber Soul. Whereas there's kind of, it's like there's a sort of perfect platonic version of Let It Be out there somewhere, and we just see these sort of rough secondary approximations of it. And also, of course, it's an album that's so tied up with the Beatles' story, you know, in a certain kind of way. It's almost telling part of the story of the Beatles, particularly their kind of breakup. So in that sense, I think it's just a fascinating little glimpse into the Beatles.
Yeah, there was so much going on. I guess the backdrop was the previous year after the White Album.
Yeah.
Full of arguments, brimming with tension. Yoko was introduced on the scene. And then business deals. When they came back from India, I think everything changed.
Yeah.
John kind of took on a leadership role and then kind of veered into heroin, which does have quite a big impact on his inputs in this particular album.
With hindsight, it's a strange decision that they made that, because I think the White Album came out in, what, October, something like that, in 1968. And whereas most bands would kind of go, right, well, we can take 6 months off now, January the 2nd, they do this terrible thing of hiring a film studio and thinking, why don't you make a film about us rehearsing for this live concert? They haven't planned what the live concert's going to be, where it's going to be. They haven't written most of their songs. And, as you say, John Lennon, I mean, he's very obsessed with Yoko. He's very obsessed with heroin, it seems. Yoko's recently had the miscarriage. They've had the drugs bust. So there's a real sense in which things are really changing for them. And he turns up, he doesn't seem to have written any songs. And whereas Paul, who always seems to have this kind of unbelievable work rate, drills them, kind of, right, come on, lads, let's get into this thing. He's got this idea of making the movie and doing the concert. And he turns up with a whole load of songs. So it's a bit of a recipe for some clashes.
And then you've also got George, who's turned up with a load of songs.
Yeah.
None of which they particularly that keen on doing.
Yeah, I know.
So you got that additional frustration.
Yeah.
Ringo, who'd recently quit on the White Album, he'd come back. Now, I guess he was hopeful at best.
Yeah.
Possibly planning his tank engine future in the background. But there was an undeniable air of tension.
Yeah.
How they managed to salvage anything from this is quite remarkable.
I suppose the thing that's sort of funny about the kind of Twickenham Savile Row sessions is actually there wasn't very much of them. I mean, I know George Harrison called it their winter of discontent, didn't he? But actually, I think they, you know, they go in on the 2nd of January. I think George walks out on the 10th. Mm. So, you know, there's little more than a week there. Then they kind of go to Savile Row for about a week and a half.
Yeah.
And but actually, in that time, even though we sort of think, we always think of it as this disaster and it produces this sort of rather kind of slightly patchy, unsatisfactory album, actually, the amount of stuff they record there, there's a ton of George's first solo album that they they don't particularly like, but they do kind of rehearse and record. They there's quite a lot of, a couple of songs off the Imagine album. There's McCartney's first solo album. Almost all of Abbey Road is premiered there, or they give it a go there. So actually, they do quite a lot, as well as some terrible jamming and some really clunky versions of old rock and roll classics.
Yeah.
So it's a funny mixed thing that when you sometimes listen to those little bootleg things, endless bootlegs you can get, it sort of sounds like they're actually having quite a lot of fun, except when they're really not.
Yeah, she's quite like the first song on the album, Two of Us. That was one of the awkward moments in the film where George was saying, I'll play whatever you want me to play, whatever it is will please you. But that was the backdrop onto this free, joyous song that they managed to eventually produce from that. Because originally it was a far rockier version as well.
That's right. It's a lot faster in the movie, isn't it, I think? Yeah, it's weird. The movie's also part of the problem with this record, because it paints such a awful picture, and it's something to do with the graininess of it. It really does make it seem like the most miserable time that they were having. And what's weird, of course, is that I think when you read stuff about what was actually going on, the real tension was between John and George, and actually that's why George walks out, because I think they have a fist fight or something. Or
it's not far off,
it's something like that. But there's that bit where Paul has a go, or he's sort of, Paul and George butt heads, and Paul has that awful, not trying to get
everything
on your nose,
I do,
I'm trying
is
to
irritating
help you.
I've had that conversation with my wife loads of times.
But he, so it's sort of, it always looks like it's, it always, you always think it's going to be, it's Paul and George that are the problem, but I think actually it's John constantly taking the piss out of George's songs, refusing to play on them, saying they're too hard and they've got too many chords.
Yeah,
and and that's where a lot of the tensions come from. But Two of Us is given all of that, is this amazingly breezy, sunny, nostalgic, sweet, folky song. And it's a great start to the album, I think.
Two of us wearing raincoats, standing solo in the sun. You and me chasing paper, getting nowhere on our way back home. We're on our way home.
There's old photos of the Beatles when they used to rehearse at Paul's house.
Right.
And it's literally John and Paul on acoustic guitar, strumming away, totally lost in the moment, just enjoying it and living it. And it's kind of the last dregs of that being eked out in the final album.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it has got that little joy of reminiscing about the youth. But because it was more about Paul and Linda.
Right.
But the fact they sing it together, you can't help but think it's, they still love each other despite all of the rubbish that's going on in the background.
Yeah, that's it. It is interesting, isn't it? Because it just, I've read that so many times that he's really writing it about Linda, but it just doesn't go in, because I just think of it as being absolutely about Paul and John. And it's, I think it's, what I love about the song as well is, it's a very typical Paul song. It sounds really simple, but when you actually, if you listen hard to it, it has these really strange metrical shifts, and actually the lengths of the lines keeps changing, and it's got that fantastic, I love the way that in the, that middle eight bit, the You and I Have Memories bit, it sounds like this soaring and sweet thing, but it's right in the minor key for most of it, so it's actually got this bittersweet quality to it. One thing I think is is really interesting as well, of course, because they had this sort of rough idea, didn't they, that they were going to not do studio trickery, and it was going to everything. They thought it was going to be a concert, and it turns into sort of an album with a live kind of feel to it, with no overdubbing and so on. As a sort of getting back to their roots sort of idea. And what's interesting to me, I think, is that for Paul in particular, that becomes kind of thematic all the way through, because this song has got that sort of looking back nostalgic quality. The Long and Winding Road has that as well. Obviously, reviving One After 909 has a bit of that. And there's a real sort of sense, even, of course, Let It Be itself with the Mother Mary stuff, that it's got this really interesting reflective quality to it, and I think that's one of the things that really struck me when I was listening to it again for this, actually.
Okay, to me, you're doing good. You never change drumming now. Yeah, that's okay. Okay,
just cut out.
All right, Glynis, we're off again. Yeah. Okay. A one, two, three. A one, two, three.
Dig a Pony, very heavy going as far as I'm concerned, but it's from the Rooftop Sessions, but originally they were planning, as you say, to do a live gig, perhaps on a cruise ship. Yeah. There was talk of an empty auditorium.
Yeah.
And Paul was just passionate, just come on boys, get together and do something, but that lethargy pretty well overran the whole thing, and this song is lethargy, heavy lethargy.
Yeah, I must say, it's not one of my favourite songs. I mean, I really like I love that slinky kind of riff at the beginning where they're all kind of playing in unison. It's got that kind of nice snaky thing to it. But there's a sort of, I think sometimes John has that kind of cryptic messiah persona that where he sort of thinks he can sing anything at all and it'll be sort of significant. I don't think this is one of those ones where it doesn't come off.
Yeah.
It just feels like he sort of, it's diminishing returns for me, this song, that kind of endless variations on the, you know, you can iterate any whatever you doofus. So, yeah, I do find that a bit weird. What's kind of interesting, if you hear the Rooftop version, which you can, those kind of bootlegs are around, that kind of All I Want Is You thing actually kind of starts the song after the opening riff, and it's funny when you hear that, it feels like it's a love song, and all the sort of You Can Syndicate Any Boat You Row stuff is just sort of secondary. But I don't know why Phil Spector does it, but he just snips that out, so it ends up seeming like it's trying to be a more serious statement. So I sort of wonder if maybe we're just hearing the song wrong.
Phil Spector ended up with the tapes, obviously, and they said, here you go, sort it out, do something. And he did some very strange things. Obviously, the famous one is the strings and choir on Long and Winding Road. But also, when he did Long and Winding Road, he wiped one of Paul's vocal tracks just so he could get more orchestra in. So he was pretty confident in what he was doing. He decided, I don't like that bit, that's not going in.
He's pretty cryptic, obviously, as a figure. I mean, I'm not a revisionist about this. I do think Phil Spector did some dreadful, dreadful things on this. The only thing I would say is that actually when you hear someone like Two of Us, actually that does sound pretty great. And I think Phil Spector's mix is really strong. And partly it's that thing that apparently when they were in Abbey Road, they were quite frustrated by the sort of white-coated technicians who would kind of say, well, you can't play it that loud because it'll start to distort, and, you know, everything has to be at a certain volume, whereas at Savile Row they could do things in a different way. And actually, I think you hear that on this record a lot. The bass sounds a lot louder and kind of boomier and clunkier. I feel like you can really hear the instruments in a much less smooth sort of George Martin way. And Phil Spector actually really suits that to some extent. So I think lots about this album actually sound kind of great when he hasn't smothered them in his rubbish.
You like the two?
Words are flowing out like endless rain into a paper cup. They slither wildly as they slip away across the universe. Pools of sorrow, waves of joy are drifting through my opened mind, possessing and caressing me.
The Universe, back in February 68, they originally did this, and John loved it. It was a dream. He dreamt the lyrics.
Right.
I think originally it was an argument with Cynthia.
Right.
And he just had these words of flowing out, little line going through his head. Rushed downstairs, and it was all very flower power. You know, it came in a dream, the song came to me, you know, this kind of thing. And he loved it, and Paul and the rest of the band weren't that keen on it, so the recordings, despite the one on Anthology, which is fantastic, beautiful, light, flowery version, the one they eventually gave to the World Wildlife Fund...
Yeah, that's right.
...was, yeah, it was good, but it was just, I think they sped it up, and they had the two girl fans...
That's right, outside, yeah.
...Lizzie Bravo and Gaylene Pease.
Ah, nicely.
Give Pease a chance.
Remembered.
Oh, yeah. I'll be here all week. And, yeah, so anyway, they rehearsed that in Twickenham,
right?
And there was no enthusiasm whatsoever. John was very upset by it, saying, I think he treasured this little trinket.
Right.
And Paul didn't really, wasn't that keen. So John was like, oh, okay, we'll do a fast one. And then Phil grabbed it, slowed it down, and then again, the orchestra's once again, so...
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? I never really know what I think about this song. It's sort of... I think slowing it down makes it more dirgy than it needs to be, and adding all the sort of heavenly choirs makes it sound more pious than it needs to be. So I agree with you. The Anthology version is much the best version that there is. This version just seems a little bit sort of like it's bombastically trying to make a statement, whereas it feels like it's actually. The thing, reason why it's so odd on this record is it's clearly not the John Lennon of January 1969. It's the sort of Rishikesh, you know, sort of folky, you know, beginning spiritual John. And so it's sort of, it just feels like it's not meant for this at all. And also that's the other reason why John is so difficult in the Twickenham sessions, because he's insisting if they're going to do a gig, or they have to do fast songs, and so quite why he thinks Across the Universe is going to be appropriate for a festival crowd.
Yeah.
I don't know what that's about, really. So yeah, it's a funny old song.
Yeah, Glyn Johns was originally given the job of mixing the first. I think he did two mixes. When Phil Spector came involved, he picked the songs that Glyn had picked rather than go through all of those. So already you'd cut out a lot.
Right.
And I think the big failure was Don't Let Me Down,
which
was a big part of the film.
That's right.
Just not on the album at all.
Very strange, and it was sort of smuggled away on a B-side. It seems a really strange thing to do for what is surely John's strongest song from all those sessions. And they do it, like, there are a couple of books of listing everything that happened in those sessions, and they do it, like, sort of 30, 40 times.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's a really strange decision. Which, that's why, I don't know if you've heard Let It Be Naked, the Paul's kind of revenge porn version of Let It Be. But he quite rightly restores Don't Let Me Down on there and gets rid of Dig It, which we will
come to shortly. Very shortly.
I'm in love for the first time. You know it's gonna last. It's a love that lasts forever.
You're part of me.
It's a love that has no past.
Next we have I'm Me Mine. And this was the last ever song the Beatles recorded, sans John, in February 3rd, 1970, he said. Right. Beginning of 1970.
That's anyway. The last session working on that, yeah. That's right. And this is this is the good example of John being really destructive to George, actually, isn't it? Because there's that recording where George is playing it and John's kind of says, you know, oh, sort of run along, son, we're a rock and roll band, because it's a waltz. Waltz time song, which is kind of weird. He obviously had forgotten that Digger Pony is also in 3/4 time. And so you see there's that bit in the film, isn't there, where he and Yoko are waltzing around to it, and in the film it seems like this is a kind of sweet bit of the Beatles having fun, but of course this is actually John saying this is a horrible song that we should not be doing.
George fuming quietly in the background.
Exactly. I've got to say, I don't like this song.
Really?
It's one of my least favourite songs.
I love this song.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
Interesting. What do you like about it?
I'd probably like the fact that most people don't like it and being annoying. Yeah, it's got everything. It's got the beautiful organ sound, veering back to his sort of Blue Jay Way era.
Yeah.
The lyrics, I believe, were partly inspired by LSD, as in searching the ego, I me mine, this kind of thing. But also the business deals that are going. But I just think the performance is absolutely fantastic, his guitar on it. And also, possibly because it is the last recording, and it's kind of, that was it.
I mean, I do agree with you. I think the performance of it is great, and there are wonderful layers in it. I think it's just, for me, a problem I have with George Harrison, is that for all his sort of kind of spiritual, otherworldly Zen qualities, he has got a slightly sour view of the world, and he so often has this slightly sort of misanthropic, why is everyone else less perfect than I am? The worst version of that is Within You, Without You, which is these horrible people sitting around talking about how dreadful the rest of the world is. But but in this, I sort of feel a bit like, he was as capable of ego as absolutely anyone else, and yet here he is denouncing ego. And as you say, it's sort of weird that they record the final versions or their final takes of this in February 1970, him talking about ego just before he's about to record a triple solo album, which is about as egotistical as you can get. So I just feel there's something a bit sour about and finger waggy about this song.
They're in that position of, demigods, the world is their oyster.
Yeah.
They can do whatever they want. And they must have been told this, despite everybody saying, Elvis was surrounded by yes men.
Right.
And the Beatles stayed grounded because they kept each other, the Liverpool wit. But they must have, everybody's telling you every day you are a demigod.
Yeah.
I guess you're going to have that, feel the right to complain and moan at everybody else.
Yeah. But it's fairly consistent through his songwriting, though, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Taxman, which is, obviously the arrangement of Taxman is just unbelievably brilliant. But I actually really hate it as a song.
Really?
Well,
because the lyrics.
Well, the lyrics, really.
Yeah.
I think the arrangement slightly disguises quite a dull song, actually, musically. But it's just that sort of kind of whingy kind of thing that George does. Whereas I think when he writes, well, we'll get on to another example, when he writes a simple love songs, actually he can be completely delightful. And that, and when we get to Abbey Road, of course, his two greatest songs for the Beatles are just these kind of completely wonderful, hopelessly optimistic, lovely things where he doesn't feel the need to sort of tell people off for their various spiritual failings.
Yeah.
Are you ready, Ringo?
Ready, George.
1, 2, 3, 4.
All through the day, I'm in mine, I'm in mine, I'm in mine. All through the night, I'm in mine, I'm in mine, I'm in mine. Now the frightened are leaving it, everyone's weaving it, coming on strong all the time. All through the day, I'm in mine.
And now we move on to the classic Dig It, which, as a, the only thing I can think of saying about this song is it's a list of things, obviously John dug, including B.B. King and Doris Day and Matt Busby. But the only thing I can think of possibly moving on, any influence it could have had on anything, was Pop Will Eat Itself, Can You Dig It? And that's all I have to say on the matter, but over to you.
Yeah, I mean, this is, it's funny because the Beatles were not a jam band, but they did an awful lot of this stuff in these sessions. There are they're actually kind of funnier songs. There's that kind of White Power Step Off song, which is actually quite funny, I think. And whereas this one, it's really weird. He just puts a kind of minute of it. Not that you'd want the full 12 minutes or whatever it is. But, I mean, I think this is another... It's that really strange thing, I think, that that Phil Spector, on one level, really tried to honour that idea that this was going to be a rough, improvised, you know, kind of back-to-basics, stripped-down, show-your-workings kind of album. So he puts in all the little bits of studio chatter and John's jokes and things and the sycophantic laughter of everyone around. But then on the other hand, he makes some really bizarre interventions, does extraordinary overdubs, and does completely opposite of what they wanted. So I don't know what he thought he was doing by this.
There was talk, and again, this is from John, so it could be true or it could be not, but the fact that Dig It and Maggie May were placed either side of Let It Be would kind of take the piss out of Let It Be.
Yeah, it's a funny thing to do to a song as extraordinarily brilliant as Let It Be. It seems to me, why particularly do you want to take that down? And particularly then, if you're going to stick more instrumentation and make Let It Be into a bigger sounding song, it sort of seems an odd choice. I mean, I think I quite like the just the little sort of slight undermining of it that kind of suggests they're not taking themselves too seriously. But this idea that they were deliberately trying to sabotage Let It Be seems like a bit of an odd thought.
I hope it's not true.
Sync to second clap, please. When I find myself in times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. And in my hour of darkness, she is standing right in front of me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. Let it be, let it be, let it be, let it be. Whisper words of wisdom, let it be.
So yeah, Let It Be. And another, as with Across the Universe, inspired by a dream, Paul dreaming of his mother.
Yeah.
Obviously with Alan Klein, all the business deals, all the arguments, and effectively I think it was a dream where she said, don't worry, it's going to be okay. And I think that was pretty well the basis of the song.
Yeah. I mean, as I've just said, I think this is a completely wonderful song. I read somewhere that he wrote Let It Be and The Long Winding Road on the same day.
Ooh, I don't know. I know he wrote it during the White, both of them during the White album.
Oh, is that right?
I don't know about the same day.
I think it's in Ian MacDonald somewhere that he says he says he wrote on the same day. Because if he did, that is some Mozart level wizardry.
That is, yeah.
You know, I kind of think if you're a songwriter, you would kind of feel pretty satisfied if in the entirety of your life you'd written two songs as good as Let It Be and Long Winding Road, and he writes them on the same day. Yeah. That's madness.
What a man.
Yeah, and actually, now this is, I think, where Phil Spector really does a great job, actually. I think that he does put a load of brass on it, but actually it's quite subtle, and actually it just adds a sort of shimmer to the song. And the thing I think is just, I absolutely love about this version of Let It Be, which I think is better than all the others, is George's guitar solo, which I think is absolutely wonderful because it is so noisy and rough, and it that does a really smart thing of turning a song which could seem like a sort of slightly schmaltzy, you know, semi-religious song, and turns it into something much more exciting and rough and powerful. And it comes, it also comes straight after the first time you hear the kind of church organ version of the main theme, and then he just blasts in with this thing. And there are kind of like four or five different versions of Let It Be around, and this is definitely for me the best take. He does some other slightly odd things. There's a kind of weird echo effect he puts on the hi-hat that always irritates me when I'm listening to
it. Ringo re-recorded the drums again. I think this was the day after I Me Mine. That was the final time they're in the studio, just doing overdubs on Let It Be. So I think Ringo actually did some more drums on that. Again, Phil, why he did that, who knows? Who wants to go into that mind? Not me.
No, absolutely. And but yeah, I also, I think this is a really good example of Phil Spector recording in a way that George Martin wouldn't, actually to the benefit of the song, that Paul's bass, or is it Paul's bass, or is it George, John?
I think John's on bass on this.
Possibly, but the bass sounds really, it's nice and loud and fat and exciting on this. Paul's vocal is beautiful on this take, I think. I just think this is completely brilliant song. I love it. Much better than the single, weirdly.
Yeah, with the single version, I had the old guitar solo, which is just a bit floppy, really.
This is the period as well where George puts everything through the Leslie speaker.
Yeah.
And it sort of sounds to me a little bit sort of whiffly and like it sounds like a Hammond organ rather than a guitar, whereas on the record, on the album, it's got that kind of real distorted quality that I just think makes the hairs stand up on the back of my neck.
Absolutely. So straight from that into Maggie May, song about a prostitute robbing a sailor.
Yeah.
So there you go. Any more to add?
I think it's a bit cheeky they put this in the track listing. I mean, it's just like, you know, they should put, if they're going to put this on, they should put Danny Boy on the track listing as well. I just think it's that's padding the track listing out to put that on.
Yeah. Well, if you exclude Maggie May and Dig It, there's only 10 songs really on the album.
I've got a feeling deep inside, oh yeah.
I've Got a Feeling, which were two songs, Paul's I've Got a Feeling and John's Everybody Had a Hard Year, stapled together to create, what did they create? What do you think?
Yeah, I love this. I think this is one of the highlights of the record. What's kind of, it's sort of interesting, I think people who don't like this song would probably have the same reasons why I like it, which is they will probably say it's two half-hearted songs stitched together. It's, for me, somehow, there's something, I think, Paul's half, which feels to me like a sort of draft one of Maybe I'm Amazed, in a way. It's got that same kind of passionate, you know, really heartfelt, he's found love kind of feel to it. But it is essentially quite simple and quite thin, I suppose. But then the point when John's vocal comes in, it just seems to really lift the song. But then John's bit without Paul's bit would probably sound like another one of his sort of surreal lists. So I think somehow the thing works together just really, just really exciting way.
Yeah, it's the counter melody at the end as well, where they're both doing their own thing. It's
they do that kind of quad libet thing where they just sing it together, which I think is really, I think it works brilliantly well.
Right, One After 099, which is an old Quarryman song. There's recordings back in 1960 with Stuart Sutcliffe on kind of on bass. And obviously they tried to record it on the same day as From Me to You and Thank You Girl.
Right.
That was held back until the anthology, which they also apparently they recorded What Goes On, the original John version of that, which is never... They didn't have time to do it, but that would have been interesting to hear.
Because the version on Anthology is not very good, so you can see why they shelved it. Mm. And even though I think this is a pretty nothingy song, it does kind of show their confidence and kind of their musicianship, actually, because this is another rooftop performance, I think. It is the rooftop performance. And actually, they've sped it up. It's got much more of a kind of rattling rhythm to it. George has got a lovely kind of twangy guitar thing he's doing all the way through. There's that kind of brilliant Billy Preston Morse code kind of electric piano. I think Ringo really drives it brilliantly. It comes across as a much better song than it is.
It's a different rhythm as well. But I think Billy Preston, you're saying, his bringing him into the band, because that was when George came back, that was one of his conditions, that we want Billy Preston, we want to relocate to the Apple Studios. But once Billy arrived, the joy seemed to just absolutely lift.
There's that thing they say in the Anthology documentary, that it was sort of having Billy Preston in, everyone had to be a bit more on their best behaviour, which is actually a really smart move. And you see them all sort of, you know, smiling and shaking hands.
It's like the vicar coming round after you've had an argument.
Yeah, exactly.
Would you like a cup of tea?
That's
very kind of you.
And of course it works really well. And actually Billy Preston contributes some fantastic stuff to Don't Let Me Down and Get Back and this. Just really adds something exciting to it. So, I love that.
To The Long and Winding Road, which again, this was another bone of contention for Paul with the flabby and flatulent orchestration and choirs.
Yeah.
And we've got a number of versions. It was number one in America. So would that have been a kind of the final swan song for them? Does the orchestration, looking back, was it okay?
I hate the orchestration. I absolutely hate the orchestration. And it's funny that, you know Phil Spector's Christmas record, which of course is, just an absolute work of genius. But the thing that absolutely spoils it at the end, he does that awful version of Silent Night with loads of strings and Phil Spector doing this awful kind of, hey guys, it's Phil Spector here, and, shucks, we've had a great time recording this, and it's awful and mawkish. And I kind of, this is again a theory I've never shared before.
Go for it.
But I think when, at the end of the White Album, when John writes Good Night, it's like a parody of that. It's Good Night rather than Silent Night. And it's got that. And George Martin, for the one and only time, deliberately does a tasteless string arrangement. And then Phil Spector does exactly that kind of tasteless string arrangement on Long Winding Road.
With no sense of irony whatsoever.
No sense of irony. As if he kind of goes, oh, those guys really love my string stuff because I heard it on Good Night. And I think the thing I most dislike or resent about the orchestration on Long and Winding Road is also I think it's transferred its effects to the song itself, in that I think a lot of people think of the Long and Winding Road as being this sentimental schmaltzy song, whereas I think actually, and when you hear it in its stripped down version on Anthology or on Let It Be Naked, it's a very emotionally raw song about finding love after various failures, and it's really, really heartfelt and very beautiful and very clever and emotionally sophisticated, and not at all this sort of awful, horrible, slushy thing that Phil Spector's made it into. I think musically, I'm not a musicologist, so I'm not very good at being able to describe this, but I love the way that it seems to kind of it kind of restlessly avoids its kind of tonic note.
Yes.
And it's constantly sort of, every time it touches on it, it moves off as if it's sort of, and I kind of hear that as being a kind of emotional fragility in the song. I love the way that the verse starts in the minor and sort of painfully makes its way to the major, and then the middle eight reverses that, and it seems it's got that really, really subtle, very affecting musical quality that really supports those words. So I think this is just an absolutely astonishing Paul song that has been almost ruined for posterity by Phil Spector.
Yeah, man, that syrupy Disney orchestration. Have you read the letter that Paul sent to Alan Klein?
No.
It said, "Dear sir, in future, no one will be allowed to add to or subtract from recording of one of my songs without my permission. I had considered orchestrating the Long and Winding Road, but I decided against it. I therefore want it altered to these specifications. Number one, strings, horns, voices, and all added noises to be reduced in volume. Two, vocal and Beatle instrumentation to be brought up in volume. 3. Harp to be removed completely at the end of the song, and original piano notes to be substituted. 4. Don't ever do it again." So that went down, and nothing happened, and it just went out as it was. So you can almost, so Paul was absolutely livid.
Yeah.
But you've made me want to actually listen to that song, because I've, for the same reasons with the orchestration, I just couldn't listen to it. But your description, I should want to dig it out, or the Let It Be Naked version at least.
Yeah, it really, beautiful. Yeah, it's the other thing as well is Phil Spector's chosen one of the worst takes of the song as well. I mean, Paul's vocal is, there are loads of fluffs and his voice cracks in it, but and not in a good way, but obviously he doesn't care, as you said, that amazing thing that he even deletes one of the vocal tracks to make more room for his terrible mush. Yeah. Weird, really weird decision.
Yeah, it is Phil Spector we're talking about, I guess.
Okay.
Because you're sweet and lovely, girl, it's true. I love you more than ever, girl, I do.
For you, Blue, very much welcome relief after the heavy going orchestration before, but yeah, what do you think of this?
Yeah, I think this is great. I think this is a really, really lovely song by George. And I know people say this is terribly simple or simplistic or something, but actually, I think it's where George was actually really quite plugged into what music was doing at the time, because he's just been hanging out with Bob Dylan, hasn't he? And Bob Dylan's just recorded Nashville Skyline, where Dylan's got quite a lot of songs a bit like For You Blue,
yeah,
on that record. And there's that deliberate turning away from, you know, that kind of Baroque poeticism to something that's much more sort of rooted and authentic. And I think this song is completely delightful and fun and affectionate. And I think George is kind of schoolboy giggling in the middle at John's dreadful slide guitar playing is all part of the enjoyment of it. So I think this is a great song.
Yeah, it's lovely too. And another song for Patty Boyd to notch up on her list of songs that's been written about her. Wow. That's got to be a compilation album in the making, isn't it? The songs for Patty. I'm going to write one just so I can include it on the...
Do that, all yeah. That.
Get back, Loretta. Your mommy's waiting for you. Wearing a high-heel shoe and a low-neck sweater. Get back home, Loretta.
Finally, we come to Get Back, which again is a different version to the single version.
Yeah, I love this song. I think it works brilliantly as a single, because it's just, you know, it's sort of blistering and it stands alone in the way that they're great singles. I sometimes never quite connect them with the albums they were making at the same time because they're such brilliant little statements in themselves. So I don't think it's particularly great on the record. It's not. I don't think it's the right song to end the album with somehow, which is why I think when they do Let It Be Naked, it starts the album, which makes a lot more sense somehow, because it just sort of gets things going. And I think it's fun. I think Paul's lyrics are good on this, and it's a little bit status quo, isn't it?
This
song, but
nothing wrong with that.
We can
in
always
its place.
We can always have exactly. You can always have a bit of quo.
Yeah. And also transgenderism, they were talking about, with JoJo.
That's right.
And the Kinks with Lola. It was all around this time.
Obla-dee, obla-da. You know.
Oh, is there nothing they didn't see?
Yeah, absolutely. there's a compilation there.
There
Beatles
is.
Beatles attack on cisgender stereotypes. Yeah.
But, so what are your overall thoughts on the album?
It's not an album that I very often listen, sort of put on and listen to the whole of. In the way that, you know, I think Abbey Road is such a pleasurable thing just to sort of sit and go through that whole journey with, or Pepper or Rubber Soul. But I think there are so many great moments on it. I mean, I think more than half of the songs are among the greatest songs they recorded, and there are some fantastic versions of them here. It's obviously overshadowed by the breakup. And what I'd love to know is the cover, when the cover was designed, because it so looks like a death announcement, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Everyone boxed off and looking away from each other, and the black border, and so on. That I don't know whether they kind of went, oh, the Beatles have broken up. Let's junk the happy one with the flowers and put this black border around it. In a sense, that kind of shapes so much of You Hear It as being a song of them not working together. But actually, you know, you listen to something like One After 909, you think this is a fantastic band that really know how to play together and play together really well and have fun. And I think there's a lot more fun on this record than generally people remember.
Mm. Well, there you go. Go and dig it out, everybody. And
dig it.
Dig it. Like a rolling stone. And also, I would suggest having a listen to Let It Be Naked as well, just to get what could have been the original album, perhaps.
Absolutely.
Dan, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for your recollections on this final Beatles album, and all the best.
Cheers, thanks for
To keep up to date with future podcasts, go to iamtheeggpod.com, or you can follow us on Twitter at iamtheeggpod. Thanks very much.